This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Up, you pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to part two of episode 69 of Chart Music. Here I am, Al Needham, and oh, look who's over there, Taylor Parks.
Yeah, all right.
Fucking hell, look over there, it's David Stubbs.
How do?
Oh, boys, so good to have you back, and I must admit, I am still massively delighted that we invented a brand new game in part one of this episode. This, I believe, is going to set the dinner parties of 2023 absolutely alight. That game, of course, is Pantomime Horse. Shall we play a few more rounds, chaps, before we get stuck in?
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Okay, little and large.
Oof.
I think Eddie would make Sid go in the front and he'd think that was a really nice gesture, but it was actually going to be a trick. Mm. Like, put a firework up his arse or something.
Yeah.
No, if you put a firework up the arse of someone in front of you in a pantomime horse, I think the joke would be on you, wouldn't it?
Pretty much. Yeah. I think Sid would really get into the part and do loads of whinnying and throwing his head back while Eddie's at the back showing everybody what John Wayne's arse would look like in a pantomime horse with deputy dogs and just spoiling it. Okay, moving on. Ian Paisley and Gerry Adams.
Ooh. I think they might agree a cordial sort of... Because they've got kind of cordial Ian Paisley with people like Mark Dinginis towards the end. So I think they'd have a sort of cordial sort of rota, you know. One time it was Paisley, one time Adams.
Mm. Yeah. You'd have to end up with a horse with a head at each end, like Noah and Nellie's Skylar.
And finally... Therese Bizarre and David Van Day. Oh, you knew that was coming.
Oh, there's no way that Van Day is going to go down.
So he'd be up front and he'd be like, now look, you stay there, I'm going to show you something about charisma.
Yes. All right then, pop craze youngsters, it is now time to go way back to December of 1974. Always remember, we may coat down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget they've been on top of the pops more than we have. It's 20 minutes past five on Friday, December the 27th, 1974, and Top of the Pops, now into its second decade and officially the longest running pop show in the world, is about to broadcast the final episode of a year fraught with mither. A BBC technician strike in the last week of May left the show struggling to cobble together an episode and eventually rammed it with repeat performances and had to cancel its special episode about David Cassidy's farewell to the pop scene. And when the strike solidified into a full-on walkout a fortnight later, the show was taken off the air for 7 weeks, leaving the pop-crazed youngsters turning on their dad's tellies of a Thursday evening and discovering extended highlights and punditry from the World Cup, repeats of Dad's Army, and Are You Being Served? Could have been worse. Could have been Are You Being Served all the time.
Yeah. That's not too bad. I'd have tolerated that.
So, as is the style, chaps, this episode is part two of Top of the Pops' review of the year, where the winners of 1974 get to stand on the top deck of a bus and be driven around the city of pop, waving at folk and brandishing silverware. We do like these episodes, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, the first part was on Christmas Day, sandwiched between Holiday on Ice and the Queen's Speech, and it was presented by Tony Blackburn and Jingle Nonce OBE. Here's what was on it, chaps. You tell me who the winner is in these two episodes. Lonely This Christmas by Mud.
Ow.
Love Me For A Reason by The Osmonds.
Meow.
Sad Sweet Dreamer by Sweet Sensation.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pants people dressed as ballet clowns, for you won't find another fool like me by the new seekers.
Ding dong.
Gonna make you a star, David Essex.
Hey.
All right.
Billy, don't be a hero by paper lace.
Well, sorry, Al.
I'm ignoring you. When will I see you again by the 3 degrees? Everything I Own by Ken Booth.
You gay pop reggae.
Waterloo by ABBA.
Hey.
She by Charles Aznavour.
She knew the days I can't forget. The beautiful regret.
Pants people dressed up all posh for you, the first, the last, my everything by Barry White.
Hello.
And of course... And of course, Merry Christmas, Everybody by Slade.
Nice.
Hoorah.
I mean, I think we're getting the better end of the deal with this episode.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
But there's been a price to pay there, because while the Christmas Day episode made some sort of sense with the idea that Tony Blackburn and Jimmy Savile live together and they've invited their pop mates round for a soiree, this episode has pretty much been left to fend for itself, hasn't it? So we get no audience, we get an earless environment, and crucially, no pants people, man.
No.
They spunked their pants people quota in one go on Christmas Day for dads.
Yeah.
Not right.
No. Unfair to dads.
So, your hosts this episode are Dave Lee Travis, who spent the year filling in for various weekday DJs on Radio 1 from time to time, while holding down his regular request show spot at 3 p.m. on Sundays, and sort of acting as a hairy tinned salmon sandwich, if you will. It won't be until 1976 that he holds down a permanent weekday slot, but he's not arsed in the slightest, because he's raking in up to £300 a night, £2,600 in today's rubbish money, from his personal appearances in provincial discos, a fee which has no doubt been boosted by his elevation to the top of the Pops talent pool in November of 1973. And this is his 13th appearance on Top of the Pops. Your other host, Noel Edmonds, who has just completed his first full year in the alpha male role on Radio 1 as the host of The Breakfast Show, which was solidified in August of this year when he was selected to present the week-long BBC One splurge on the Osmonds, which peaked when he joined them to present that week's Top of the Pops. He's been a presenter since July of 1972 and is now part of a talent pool which currently consists of Travis, Jingle Nonce OBE, Tony Blackburn and Paul Burnett. Oh, here they are again. Happy as can be. All good pals in jolly good company.
Yeah. There's something about the casual, carefree way that DLT is humming along with the Top of the Pops theme tune when we first see him, before he rolls into his usual nightmarish, humourless humour babble shtick. Just seems to radiate pure contempt for the programme and for you and me and his mother, and indirectly everybody's mother.
Yes.
But, you know, at this point, unlike 80s DLT, he's not jaded and yawning his way through it. He's full of enthusiasm, which on the one hand is terrible, but on the other, it's still terrible. But the only thing that makes him less than 100% repulsive here is that he hadn't yet developed that little spider's web of grey hair up the front of his cunt fro, which would, you know, break through in about 1978 or 79 and complete the skin-crawling wrongness, because he's more disturbing when he's visually coded middle-aged rather than this relative youngster whose overbearing creepiness could, with excessive charity, be written off as youthful high spirits. You know, you could almost think of him here as just another cunt, you know. And the one sense in which Dave Lee Travis is exceptional is that he's not just another cunt.
No.
He is toxic mega cunt. He is the cunt of Monte Cristo. Always on, pinching a girl's arse with a sausage sandwich in the other hand, eternally.
He's the top, he's the tip, he's the championship, he's the most tip-top. Top cunt.
Cunt to end all cunts.
Close friends get to call him DLT, but he hasn't got any actually. Where do we start with these two and what they're wearing? I mean, both of them have come dressed for the occasion. Edmonds is sporting a black dinner jacket with a massive black bow tie, which makes him look like he's being savaged by a bat. And of course, as any pop craze youngster will tell you, he always makes an effort when he's on the programme. Article in the Daily Mirror last week. It's Natty Noel. Noel Edmonds bought a new suit yesterday because tonight he's comparing Top of the Pops. He has a new suit every time he appears on the programme. The kids who watch the show notice these things, he told me. They complain every time I wear the same shirt and tie more than once. With a regular monthly slot on Top of the Pops, Noel buys at least 12 suits a year. I pay about £30, and I prefer the off-the-peg three-piece suits because they look very smart, he said. And, yeah, that was borne out by his adverts that were running at the time for Hepworth's Tailors with Tony Blackburn, you may recall.
Yeah.
Edmonds always went for off-the-peg because of his busy lifestyle, while Blackburn opted for made-to-measure because he was particular. But they both paid the same price of £37.50, so there you go.
Mm. The way Noel's dressed up here, he looks like young musician of the year.
Yes,
or like ninth place. You know, he played WOLD by Harry Chapin on the core anglais. It's because he always wore those 70s suits with the big shoulders and wide lapels, which are not tailored for the puny likes of Noel Edmonds. He looks disappearing into black velvet quicksand here, you know, while his mum looks on proudly. I think he thought the artificial bigness of those clothes would bulk him up a bit. But of course, it works the opposite way. It's,
of course.
He looks like he's standing 4 feet further back from the camera than DLT when actually they're side by side. I mean, I'm a bit of a short ass, and there are photos of me standing next to gigantic bears of men where that also seems to be the case. But then I don't assume the slick, superior, master of ceremonies manner of a Noel Edmonds.
I remember your tag team with Giant Haystacks.
But you just look at that bow tie. I mean, I actually thought it was a comedy, but I mean, it looks like the kind of bow tie clown would wear to another clown's funeral. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I actually genuinely thought, oh, this is comedy. No, I remember, this isn't comedy. It's the 70s. You know, these aren't intended as comedic parodies of of the day, of its moors.
Certainly not.
Did you know he went to the same public school as Douglas Adams?
Really?
Whose middle name was Noel, in yet another eerie coincidence. Both of them capable of creating an entire universe out of their own imagination, peopled with the fabulous otherworldly creations like Zaphod Beeblebrox and Mr. Blobby. Yes. I realised the other day I've now lived longer than one of those people did, and yet achieved so much less than either.
Travis, though, Travis has essentially come as a white gollywog, hasn't he?
That's it, yes. It's actually a face. It's like he's in whiteface of some sort, yes. It makes you feel racially offended. Yeah, you're right, yeah.
If Spa or Finefair made their own brand of marmalade, he'd be on the front of it, wouldn't he?
Yeah, different times, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
He's wearing an appalling shiny black suit with massive silver lapels, and he's teamed that with a dark fuchsia shirt and a white bow tie. Mm. You know those absolutely shit suits that sports personalities wear nowadays?
Mm. Yeah.
He's sort of like that. He looks like he's just been drafted in the fourth round by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, or he's off to a press conference to pretend to be angry at some other boxer in order to sell some more pay-per-views. Fucking dreadful tailoring.
Mm. I mean, I think of all the toxins running through the bloodstream of 70s star that sort of coalesce into a boil on the end of the nose of the 70s, and I think this outfit, these glasses, this beard as well, that'd be it.
So the obvious question, chaps, we have to return to it. Noel Edmonds, Dave Lee Travis, pantomime horse.
Yeah, I think these two cunts can sort it out between themselves.
Yeah. I think they would end up as a hideous push-me-pull-you, straining in different directions until their skin burst and frayed and the kiddies started screaming and crying and the dads would have to get up on stage and get involved again.
Just as long as somebody walked on stage and Blazing Saddles style punch that pantomime horse in the face.
I could just imagine a sort of thing, you know, a sort of great tussle, and Noel Edmonds' head emerging triumphantly out of the top of the horse's head, and then being pulled back down in again by Travis, and his head popping out, and so the long evening wears on.
I always wanted to go up to Bernie Clifton when he was on his ostrich. Just walk up to him, punch the ostrich in the face, and they both go down. That would be great. Anyway, look, allow me a quote from this slim volume here. The Top of the Pops Annual, 1975.
Yes!
I.e. the one that would have been in the shops and stockings right now as this episode went out.
Oh, I've actually got that, Taylor, right in front of me now. Top of the Pops Annual, 1975. It's got a big white number one on a red background.
Yeah.
And there's three circular image bits off to the sides of Savile, Noel Edmonds, Tony Blackburn, turning around the back, no DLT on it whatsoever. Oh dear, oh dear. And in the middle, a big picture of the Osmond family.
Yeah, of course.
Which is nice.
Well, this particular copy that I've got here is perfectly preserved, but absolutely reeks of somebody's shed, which I think tells its own rather poignant story.
God, yes, so does mine.
Anyway, among the features on pop groups, there are also profiles of the top DJs that we, yes, as Top of the Pops viewers, have come to think of as our extra special friends. Now, most of these interviews are clustered in one section of the annual, imaginatively titled Top DJs, yes, except for the feature on Jimmy Savile, who has this kind of early medieval king figure, has a much bigger section all to himself, written in the first person, almost as though he'd bothered to sit down and write it himself rather than talk down the phone at some hack reporter who's had to go away and assemble this shit into a coherent piece and credit it to Sir Jim. But that's at the start of the annual. That's the very first thing you see when you open it. It's a typically soothing picture of Savile with the slightly horrifying headline, Jimmy Savile, the daddy of the DJs.
Yes.
What tool? This fucking tool. Further in, you get interviews with his serfs, including one with Dave Lee Travis.
Oh, yes.
Which begins like this. Dave Lee Travis admits it. I'm a complete loony, he says. An absolute nutcase. I'd do anything for a laugh. And so the article goes on running through his career. It says, Dave spent 2.5 years in Bremen, Germany, doing his own TV show, which pulled in an audience of over 80 million viewers, which, for those of us who've seen Beat Club, specifically Travis's constant comedy sex pesting over Uschi Nurka, the main host.
Poor Uschi.
Yeah, to whom he was very much second banana, in fact, just one of a string of male sidekicks, and which very visibly makes her extremely uncomfortable. Him then going back to England and claiming he had his own show in Germany is even more grotesque. But he goes on to talk about it here, and he says, they thought I was a nutter, a maniac. So I then used to do anything at all just to get a laugh.
Well, that's interesting, Taylor, because as I found out to my cost when I went on a German exchange in 1982, the German for nutter is prostitute. I called my mate a nutter, and all the German teachers just glared at me, and I was tucked to one side and informed as to what I'd said.
Right, well, it says here that in Germany, he became known as Big Dave the English Nut. Yeah. That's what he thought they were saying. Big Dave the English Nut. It's actually a German phrase which sounds very like that, but actually translates as, I hope his arse falls off so he has to shit through his eyes. But wait, he's got more to say in this interview. He says, I'm not just a DJ, I'm a really dedicated all-round entertainer.
Oh, no!
It might sound a bit big-headed to say so, but I know I'm going to be a really big-name entertainer a few years from now.
Fuck.
Just wait and see.
Yeah.
I'll have a really monster TV show of my own.
Ooh.
And indeed, the Golden Oldie Picture Show was quite a sensation. I mean, do you think in later years his co-host on this programme ever read that quote back and chuckled darkly?
Oh, it's framed in his toilet, mate. Or one of his many toilets, no doubt.
I love it. I got so much terrible pleasure from reading that quote about how Dave Lee Travis knows he's going to be a top entertainer with a show of his own. That might actually be my second favourite quote of all time, after my mate when I was 15 eating some mushroom stroganoff, making a face and saying, "Erg, this tastes like spunk, I imagine."
So it's hastily appended there, yeah.
Noel is also featured at punishing length in the 1975 Top of the Pops annual, if you'll allow me to quote the words of the great man.
Educate us, Taylor.
He says, "Already, I think, I've proven that I'm not just another Tony Blackburn."
Ooh.
Yeah, that's nice for you. "I'm sure some of the kids had no comprehension that Gary Glitter could actually sing a song like Happy Birthday until I played it from one of his albums on my radio programme."
Oh, no.
It's really an excellent piece of music. This is the song Happy Birthday.
Not
yes,
that one.
It's about waiting until midnight so that a girl turns 16 and is legal so you can then have sex with her.
Yes.
Lyrics, 11:59, about time, one more minute to go. I can hardly wait, in this state, don't my feelings show. All we gotta do, me and you, see it through. When we do, what a big surprise I've got for you. When you're old enough, ha, I do my stuff, till you beg for more. Now the time has come, have your fun, bang you come, give me some. Look out, birthday baby, here I come. You're alone, almost grown, on your own. Move a little closer."
Fucking hell.
This is like Sean Ryder writing a song about the day drugs are decriminalised so he can take some. Anyway, Noel, in this probing piece, he got plenty more to say. He says, "There's only one fault with Top of the Pops. It doesn't give me enough time in between the numbers to set up a proper comedy situation."
Oh, you see,
I'm really a frustrated TV comedian, and I'd like to do more comedy on television.
God.
The sadly unnamed writer of this article continues here. It's not what you call a combative interview. "One young girl who was in the audience for Top of the Pops knows just what Noel means. Oof. Noel asked her during the show, 'Do you like surprises?' She innocently replied, 'Yes.' He turned away from her, then suddenly turned round and shouted, 'Boo!' Everyone in the studio roared with laughter, including the girl. That's what Noel means by being a zany character." These are the closing lines of the article. That's your takeaway. And there's the man who actually would end up with a monster TV show of his own. Not once, but on numerous occasions. God. It's funny, isn't it? One disordered psychological state and you end up in a mansion with a helicopter on the roof. Another, only very slightly different disordered psychological state, and you end up as an unemployable convicted sex offender.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real logic to it, is there?
No.
Is that the article that mentions right at the top his single?
Yes, it is.
Oh, Kirk Houston. Alcatraz. Have you heard it, chaps?
Uh-huh.
Oh, if I'd have played that to you and said, "This is a Top of the Pops presenter," you would have thought it was Travis, wouldn't you?
I think probably so, yeah. It's weird. He sounds like a throat cancer victim.
He's singing about how horrible Alcatraz is, and at the end he says, "Well, how do you think I know about all this? Because I'm the governor." It's like his fantasy, isn't it?
Well, his wank fantasy. Yes. Like to be in charge of a men's prison. They all have to do exactly what I say.
They all have to bathe in sewage.
Do we know that these two hated each other, by the way?
At the time?
Yeah, you just assume it, don't you? Partly because there was so much bad blood and bitching at Radio 1. And partly because... Well, why wouldn't they? Mm. Well, everybody else does.
Yeah. Well, neither of them is remotely likeable. Yeah.
If they did hate each other, my response is good. Now you know how we feel.
Yes.
Now you are both halfway to knowing how we feel.
Yeah, at the time I wouldn't know. I just thought they were brilliant mates.
Yeah.
I just thought everyone in pop was best mates with each other.
I mean, the thing about these two is at the time, you know, I was a pop kid and I didn't mind them at all, in fairness. And there wasn't actually a general protest against them from us pop kids because, I mean, first of all, this crap was mercifully brief. And they sort of functioned, you know, as signifiers that Top of the Pops was on. We're seconds away from pop. I mean, Raymond Baxter was a far more impressive broadcaster.
Yeah.
But he signified that Tomorrow's World was on. You know, and for fuck's sake, can we get a wriggle on with the items about talking robot waste paper baskets and roll on the closing credits?
Yeah, fuck tomorrow, we want now!
Exactly. It's like the Mr. Whippy jingle. You know, it's not like we kids, you know, we're all hand-jiving in the streets, digging that jingling vibe. We just knew that meant ice cream was imminent. But they deluded themselves, people like Travis and Edmund, to thinking that somehow they had some sort of autonomous function beyond that. And perversely, it turned out to be right.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of your friendly neighbourhood Hairy Monster and his colleague Noel Edmonds, welcome to the Christmas edition of Top of the
Pops. I'd just like to say that I completely concur with the views that have just been expressed.
We've got to work this together, son.
Oh, all right, then.
Now, we've got a host of golden hit records and the artists with them on the show.
We do.
So shall we start with...
The Rubettes! Hit with the Pavlovian twang and blare of Whole Lot of Love as the Top of the Pops logo flares up in the middle of a Christmas wreath effect, which is somewhat ruined by the array of images of this afternoon's bands and artists as they've tried to fit rectangular images into a round space. That's replaced by a shot of Travis, seemingly caught unaware at first, but quickly rallying and starting to mime the horn bits of the theme tune. He reminds us that he's the Hairy Monster and welcomes us to the Christmas Top of the Pops before being rudely interrupted by Edmonds in vintage BBC announcer mode. After a bit of 15% passive, 85% aggressive banter, they hold out their hands in an introductory fashion to welcome the first act on stage, the Rubettes with Sugar Baby Love. Born in Rhyl in 1941 and Liverpool in 1943 respectively, Wayne Bickerson and Tony Waddington were members of the Pete Best Four in the mid-60s, who went on to form a songwriting partnership when the band split up. Although they wrote Nothing But a Heartache for the Flirtations in 1968, the hits eluded them throughout the 60s, and they settled into providing filler for the likes of the Brotherhood of Man, Barry Ryan and Innes Fox, but when Bickerton became the head of A&R for Polydor UK, they began work on a rock and roll musical and realised that one of the songs they'd knocked out, this one, had definite hit potential. After rounding up a collective of musos to knock out some demos, the songwriters initially intended to enter this tune in that year's Song for Europe, but then offered the song to the hottest new mock and roll band in the country, Show Waddy Waddy, but they turned it down flat. And after their second choice, Carl Wayne knocked it back, they went back to their demo band and offered it to them on the condition that they formed a band. Only two of them took up the offer, but no matter. A few ring rounds to jobbing musos later, the Rubettes were formed. They were immediately signed to Polydor and the single was put out, and it did absolutely fuck all for 6 weeks, despite non-stop badgering of Radio 1 and Robin Nash from Polydor promo chief Tony Bramwell, the Beatles' Artie Fufkin. But then, on April the 24th, 1974, Robin Nash was informed that his booking of Sparks to perform This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us in the studio was off because he'd assumed that they were British, only to be told at the last minute that they weren't, they hadn't joined the Musicians' Union, and they didn't have a promo film or oat. Staring aghast at the 3-minute gap in his episode, he called Bramwell and told them if he could get the Rubettes into the studio by 7 p.m, they'd get their break. After ringing round, sending taxis out across the country and ordering in 12 sets of flared white suits and matching caps from a boutique on the King's Road because they didn't know the measurements of the band, they made their first ever appearance on the show, and a week later Sugar Baby Love entered the charts at number 27. The following week it soared 25 places to number 2, and the week after that it deposed Waterloo by ABBA to assume total dominance of Pop Mountain. Fucking hell, what a story, chaps.
Yeah, yeah.
The power of Top of the Pops, eh?
Indeed.
Question for the panel and the Pop Craze youngsters listening. What was the first number 1 single that made you angry about it being there? Because I've got to say, it was this one for me, which is absolutely mental, because there was far worse songs than this. But even then, as a child, I could rationalise the likes of Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool or Welcome Home becoming the most successful song in the country. It just felt right. But I remember seeing this on Top of the Pops and absolutely hating it because it was too slow and too high-pitched and they all looked like dads. And then I was in the playground one afternoon and I got into a huge argument with a lad there who told me that this had just got to number 1. And I absolutely refused point blank to believe him and accused him of being a liar because it just couldn't be number 1 when there was a Sweet record knocking about and they were nowhere near as good as a Sweet. And getting done and having the teacher have a word with me to stop accusing lads of lying and then watching Top of the Pops the next day and finding out that he was actually number 1.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. So fucking angry. I'm getting angry now just thinking about it.
Getting aerated, yeah.
I mean, I'm less militant about this song now, but God, it still annoys me.
Yeah. For me, it was probably, I think there's maybe a false memory, but I think it was Dawn, as it Tie a Yellow Ribbon.
Oh.
Simply because Sweet were kind of roaring up the charts with Hellraiser. And yeah, it kept it off. And it was just like, I thought, this is the week. It's got, this is the week. This is the week. And, you know, I was listening to Tom Brown or whatever. And then number 2, which is Hellraiser. What?
Yeah.
I was distraught. I was crying like a 12-year-old French boy, you know. It really was. I was on holiday at the time, and I was absolutely, you know, it blackened my mood for, you know, a good hour or so. It really did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I felt thwarted.
I don't think I ever got angry about it as a kid, but so the first record I can remember getting angry about getting to number 1 is also the last one.
Right.
Which was that record by Lenny Kravitz.
Oh, God, yeah.
I wish I could fly into the sky so very high, like a dragonfly. I heard it on an advert for a car, yes. I think. And I burst out laughing, thinking it was just a song they'd written for the advert.
Yeah.
And thought, is that really the best they could do? This is absolutely pathetic. People are just going to laugh at this. And then I heard that it was actually a real record by a real musician. Huh? And then I heard it had gone into the British charts at number 1.
Fuck.
And that was the day that I spat on this nation. And also then later America, because it also won a Grammy.
I think I was in a state of pretty much perpetual rage about what was number 1 from 1978 to 1993. But...
Anyway, here they are in the studio, you know, celebrating their breakthrough. And again, it's reminding me of another reason why I was so pissed off with the Rubettes at the time. The lead singer's got a necklace with Alan on it in gold. And up to that time, I believed I was the only person in the world with that name. So looking at him made me feel a bit less original and a bit less special.
Well, that's nice, I suppose. I mean, the geezers on the, like, the sort of bopshu waddy waddy detail, they're a bit of a chinless bunch. And there is some kind of mildly annoying, wacky humour going on. But when you're in the same building as Noel Edmonds and Dave Lee Travis, you know, you're going to be like, you know, far the less of the criminal party. I mean, they are genuinely having a bit of a laugh. I think they know it's going to be back to sort of lunchtime at the Batley Variety Club in about a year's time.
Yeah, the first thing that always strikes me about this group is that the singer is like trying to be a pin-up and the others are playing comedy ugly.
Yes, yeah.
And has there ever been an all-male band who've done that and it worked? Maybe Sparks in a different way. Can't think of any others.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, The Wurzels.
Cheap Trick.
Oh, Cheap Trick, okay. Oh, Shawaddy Waddy, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah.
There's a similar sort of overgrown juvenile look on Bartram.
Yes.
But I've always been sort of intrigued by Alan Williams, that singer, because he's got those sort of strange Slavic features and permanent Brian Jones, Barry Norman eye bags.
Yes.
There's something a bit unusual about him in the context of the mid-70s. I always assumed he must be one of those low-key foreign blokes you used to get in Britain when Britain was a lot more culturally homogenous, you know. Like, he had Yugoslavian parents who moved here in 1962 or something, you know what I mean? But he didn't make a big deal out of it. But his name's Alan Williams, so the furthest he can have come from is Anglesey, surely. You know what I mean? You see quite a lot of the other members of the Rubettes in this clip,
as
though they're like a collective. You know, it seems a bit weird. We get very well acquainted with the drummer.
Oh, yes. We learn that the Rubettes, like too many bands before and after, have been afflicted by a bad case of performative drummer.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like a sort of sub-Asquith Burke, isn't he? He's like Mr. Lucas.
Yes.
Or Mr. Spooner, depending on, you know, where you stand on that great rivalry. I think fans still duke it out over the definitive Grace Brothers junior sales assistant.
Oh, man, the fights in the Market Square on a Saturday over that, yeah. Man. But yeah, he's got a green electric bow tie that he flashes when he does the spoken word bit. And there's a lot of fakery on this because, of course, Williams mimes the castrato bit, which was done by Paul Da Vinci, who refused to join the band and would go solo later on this year. You must have seen his Top of the Pops performance of Your Baby Ain't Your Baby Anymore.
No.
Oh, wait till we get to that on Chart Music. Mm. Fuck me.
The thing is, this is actually a pretty good record, considering what it actually
is. Yes, it is.
But there's no actual point in listening to it when you could be listening to something that actually came out of the actual New Jersey in the actual early 60s.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's like buying a seersucker suit that looks okay at a glance, but it isn't, and will obviously shrink and fade and dissolve as soon as you wash it. But it costs the same as the real thing.
Mm.
Is that really required, you know?
No.
So the only thing it's got going for it is that it's here now, and you can take it or leave it, you know. And I think there's at least a discussion to be had about, you know, when so-called credible bands, i.e. not really people like the Rubettes, do something that is so closely patterned on something else that it's virtually pastiche, right? By which I mean a discussion about whether that's fair enough and then whether anyone should care. I remember a friend of mine who really loved Big Star getting into Teenage Fan Club and being a bit apologetic about it, saying, I know they're rip-off merchants. I just want some more music that sounds like that.
Which, fair enough.
When you don't have the responsibilities of a critic, that's understandable, you know. And it's doubly understandable in that case, considering that early Big Star were in a lot of ways just the Teenage Fan Club of their day, like completely unoriginal, just playing their favourite kind of music that already existed. But I think if what you're doing is heartfelt pop songs, which are at least aimed towards the emotions, you can plausibly argue that there's always room for more of them in any style. You know, you don't necessarily require the shock of the new.
Yeah.
But when it's music like this, which might be designed to create feelings, but it's not about personal emotional expression, then a very derivative record feels a little bit more like a forgery, you know. Because you feel like if an idea of their own had occurred to them at any point during recording this, they would have excluded it. Because that would have complicated the song to the detriment of what they were trying to achieve.
Clearly, they are part of that general thing that's going on at the time, you know, the attempt to sort of replicate the spirit and the style or whatever of, like, I don't know, pre-Beatles music, rock and roll, etc., etc. Because things have kind of slowed up a bit culturally. It's almost like the first postmodern moment in some ways. But at the same time, they are quite 70s in their attire. I mean, you know, they've got their shirt collars are peeping right over their shoulders, you know, so they don't go for the absolute strict sort of teddy boy type, you know, period detail. They don't really bother with that. I mean, it's a bit conceited of them, you know, given that they don't take themselves that seriously. It's a bit conceited to filch the beginning of Twist and Shout at the beginning.
Oh, God, yeah.
As if they're going to represent this new pop cultural era, you know, as if Philip Larkin's going to write, "Sexual intercourse began in 1974 with the Rubettes because nothing important had happened before," you know.
They're all in a mixture of the stage togs that they've worn throughout the year.
Yeah.
And they appear to be performing in front of the giant Iron Man in the Channel 4 idents that's just collapsed on the floor in despair at what's happened to glam.
Yeah. The companion piece for this performance, and indeed for the whole of this Christmas Top of the Pops, is that cheap and not so cheerful British film, the unfortunately titled Never Too Young to Rock.
Mm.
The word rock there, as so often, possibly a euphemism for something. made by the same people who made the naively titled Gary Glitter vehicle, Remember Me This Way. It's a film that features the Rubettes, the Glitter Band, Mudd, Bob Kerr's Whoopee Band.
Right.
We talk a lot about the grimy, mildewed, damp atmosphere of the mid-70s, but watching Never Too Young to Rock off a VHS rip, all smeary and muffled, is like having your head plunge right into that particular outside toilet all the way up to your knees. It's barely watchable, but it's in that elite class of mid-70s cultural artifacts which wouldn't be believable if you did them as a parody.
Yeah.
It would seem a bit too on the nose. With Freddie Jones as the appropriately named Mr. Rock Bottom driving around in a group detector van which apparently tunes into the modulated frequencies emitted by the pop groups required for the concert. This concert they're putting together being very important because it's going to be on TV, and if for some unspecified reason, if it doesn't get brilliant ratings, rock and roll is going to be banned from television. That's right. the plot, such as it is. And of course, this group detector van is basically a converted Second World War army ambulance with the doors rusting off, you know, and a shitty multicolored paint job. And the Rubettes' big moment in this film is miming to this track on the back of a lorry that's going slowly down Golders Green Road when it's obviously just stopped raining. And it's great, to be honest. It shows off whatever is likeable about them far better than this clip here does. Anyway, look, we'll return to that film later in this podcast, I'm sure. But basically, if you think that the natural visual accompaniment to late period glam rock is the look and feel of a public information film with about as many laughs, despite the fact that it's meant to be a comedy, then you must not sleep on this film.
No.
Or indeed fall asleep during it, which is a hazard. But definitely watch it, if you can, before the last remaining copy known to man is deleted off a hard drive somewhere to make room for more low-budget American pornography. Because there's nothing like it except feeling sick in the cold. This is a film whose closing credits include a thank you to Ready Mix Concrete Limited. A thank you that I doubt was ever reciprocated, but one that says it all.
So Sugar Baby Love would spend 4 weeks at number one, giving way to a tune we're going to be subjected to later on. The follow-up, Tonight, got to number 12 for 2 weeks in August, and they'd round off 1974 with Jukebox Jive, which is currently the Christmas number 3, and would spend 4 non-consecutive weeks there. That's a miles better tune.
Mm.
After 3 top 40 hits in 1975, they changed tack and became a proto-smoker, getting to number 40 in September of 1976 with the anti-homophobia song Under One Roof, got to number 10 with Baby I Know in March of 1977, but never bothered the charts again. However, there are 3 versions of the Rubettes still in existence today.
Of course there
good
are.
Good Lord. They should make a film about trying to book all 3 of them for a festival.
Well, bang. That was the robots for you there, lad. Oh, my arms. Oh, all the way through there.
It's a long record, isn't it?
Certainly is.
We've got the sound for you, John Denver and his song.
And what song?
No, John Denver and his song. It's
and what song?
No, it's and.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest.
We return to a shot of the outstretched forearms of Travis and Edmonds and realise that we have been subjected to a bit. We also get the chance to contemplate how meaty Dave Lee Travis's wrists and hands are. Fucking hell. They're like rowing oars, aren't they? Wouldn't like to be slapped across the face or grabbed on the arse by that.
Yeah.
After some incisive and thoughtful wordplay on the title of the next single, we're finally introduced to Annie's Song by John Denver. Born in Roswell, New Mexico in 1943, Henry John Deutschendorf Jr. was an army brat who was given an acoustic guitar by his nonna at the age of 11 and ran away from home at the age of 15 to start a musical career in California. But his dad went looking for him and dragged him back and presumably tanned his arse, and he would have fucking deserved it as well. After 1 year at Texas Tech College in 1963, he dropped out and moved to Los Angeles to begin his music career proper, playing open mic sessions in folk clubs, changing his name to John Denver, and replacing the leader of the Chad Mitchell Trio, which changed their name to Denver, Boise and Johnson, in 1965. In 1969, he signed to RCA as a solo artist and put out the LP Rhyme and Reasons. Although it failed to chart, one of the songs on it, Leaving on a Jet Plane, was picked up by Peter, Paul and Mira and took it to number one in America and number two over here. When RCA told him they weren't ready to fund a tour of America off the back of his debut LP, he decided to hit up towns and cities in the Midwest on his own, turn up unannounced at venues asking for support slots, and then hit up the local radio station and told them he was the writer of Leaving on a Jet Plane, and asked for the chance to play a few songs live and promote his gig, which garnered him a hardcore following. And when he put out his second LP, Poems, Prayers and Promises, in 1971, he landed a number two hit on the Billboard chart with Take Me Home, Country Roads. Despite a barrage of hits in America, which culminated in Sunshine on My Shoulders getting to number one, the UK wouldn't have recognised him if he'd shagged our mams. But in 1973, his manager, Jerry Weintraub, decided his artist needed his own TV show and convinced the BBC to do it, as he knew that British TV didn't cancel series mid through their run like they did in America. So, six episodes of the John Denver Show, which also featured Pan's People, were put out in the early summer of that year, but still no hits. Then, earlier this year, Denver had a row with his missus one afternoon and went off for a bit of a ski, and according to legend, he was so pumped with adrenaline after going downhill really fast on some massive sucker sticks that he wrote this song in 10 minutes while he was on the ski lift back, and decided to name it after his missus, presumably because You Fill Up My Senses sounded a bit druggy. In mid-August, when it had already been and gone as the Billboard number one, Annie's Song entered the chart at number 37 and started a two-month pull up the charts until it knocked Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas off number one. And here is a clip of him on some American TV show to commemorate that very thing. Boys, we touched upon this song when it was done by James Galway's Flute of VD in Chart Music 54, but here's the original.
Yeah. I think, you know, I need to say that there's this ongoing raging debate about whether up-and-coming flautist, sorry, copyright Abigail's Party, James Galway's version is better than Denver's. And I'm in Camp Galway, I think, on the grounds of mellifluousness. So he's got a sort of slightly sort of disagreeable warble as Denver. You know, you've got the geezers working, have to work pretty hard on that mandolin to sort of take the edge off it.
But look at this cunt. It's, you know, the Milky Bars may well be on him, but he's the only one eating them sideways, because John Denver's wide mouth frog look, it really unsettles me. Right? He looks like a rubber ball that someone's drawn a face on and sliced almost in half, and now they're squeezing the sides to make it talk. He looks like if his doctor told him to open his mouth and say "ah," his head would split in half and fold back over on itself, and his glasses would slide off at the back and hit the ground. Which wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing if that meant that he then stumbled myopically, arms held out in front of him, off the edge of the treehouse into a paddling pool full of crabs.
Mm. I mean, he is pretty much Zippy in a wig and glasses, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually strangely cybernautic, really. There's a bit of a Commander Data vibe about him. It's as if his lips are made from the same material as his face. And his hair looks weirdly silvery, like it's some sort of fine, you know, synthetic fabric that's been generated by a microchip in his skull. It's
like Bleep the Space Boy.
Yeah. Very odd indeed. Mm. What surprises me, I mean, is the story of like how it's composed, you know. I mean, it's sort of a breakneck speed, because this is one of those breather songs, you know, one song in, we have to have a breather.
Yeah, piss break.
Well, definite piss break, because it doesn't have any velocity about it at all. Back then, when I was 12, you know, my bottom lines were fast is good and slow is bad. Mm. And the weird thing is, retrospectively, actually pretty much all of the slow stuff was poor, I reckon. Mm. It's not like Guys and Gals and One and Only Nick Drake was popping up in 1974. Yes. I mean, you know, he did have exceptions. I did like I'm Not in Love by 10cc, and I admit, you know, that the Carpenters had a fairly mysterious effect on me. But generally, the slow numbers, to me, they weren't just a change of pace. They just seemed deliberately, consciously designed to dampen down the teenage rampage, you know, to deny the velocity of youth and exuberance, and try and reassert the timid innovation of, you know, the pre-rock and roll years. You know, it's anti-funk, anti-rock, anti-disco, anti-electronic, and it's willfully, maliciously tepid and twee.
Yeah, at this point, John Denver, he's pretty much a one-man Osmonds for the mums and dads, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's living that American heartland life. He's clearly not going about thinking his summer, and he's obviously real and not a bent cunt.
Yeah.
Ticks all those boxes.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, chaps, I never minded John Denver, because as the 70s went on, it was obvious that he was best mates with the Muppets, because, you know, they'd all go round his house for a bounce around on his grandma's feather bed. And as far as I know, the Muppets don't knock about with bell ends.
Mm.
Al, the reason he was mates with the Muppets is that he shared their physiognomy. But they accepted him as one of their own. No, I've got to be honest, though, I got no time for this Colorado beetle. It must be a funny place, Colorado, what it does to people, right? Whether it's Hunter S. Thompson pouring drugs into his bald head and then blowing it to pieces when he got bored. Or the empty air of Aspen, Colorado, the American Switzerland.
Yeah.
Except that Aspen actually has a long-forgotten countercultural history, which makes that even worse. Appropriately enough, for a man like this, who's essentially a cosy conservative entertainer clinging onto the hippie bandwagon, like Frank Spencer on roller skates. They just legalised magic mushrooms in Colorado.
Have they?
Apparently, yeah, which I suppose is one way to make John Denver seem interesting. Don't like him. He's got a capo on his guitar at the first fret.
Right.
Which always just seems like cheating, really. Just shunt the song into some freaky brass band key, you know, rather than just singing a semitone lower like a man, you know. And also, let's face it, even within the unholy genre of Western shirts, this is a bad
one. Oh, yes.
Like, it looks like he's wearing a denim bib over an old lady's nightie.
But, I mean, you know, he had Dee Snider's back at the PMRC hearings. He did loads of benefits off his own back. Did one in Chernobyl a couple of years after the disaster there. He was on the waiting list to get on the space shuttle before the Challenger disaster fucked all that. And he thought Ronald Reagan was a cunt.
Hmm.
Which, I mean, it's a pretty low bar.
Yeah,
but you've got to take your hat off to him.
Yeah. Mm. There's just something really unpleasant about this song. I hate the emotional build as the song goes on. The way it keeps getting bigger and more histrionic, swelling up like a boil, you know. It's just a grotesque spectacle of this wide-beaked eagle rising higher and higher on the ghastly thermals of his own wind. It's horrible to witness. But this was always going to happen in the 70s. Once the MO of the singer-songwriter moved on from poetry and social comment to relentless self-examination. Mm. The deeper people get into that, the drippier and whinier they're going to get, because ultimately that's what's inside all of us, right? So we were drowning in this stuff. You know, people opening their hearts to the world. There's something about that that's slightly dangerous, like a night out in Sheffield.
Yes.
Because it doesn't work as culture, just exposing your soul. Ultimately, it's like blokes exposing their bollocks. You know, they might appreciate the fresh air, but nobody else wants to see them. And when one person does it, at least it's a novelty. But when you live in a world where everyone's running around with their bollocks out, you're not sat there applauding everyone's bravery and vulnerability. You're just sick of seeing ugly bollocks all over the place. Yeah. And it's the same with the indistinguishably basic emotions of unexceptional troubadours. You end up thinking, all right, mate, it's your bollocks. We've all got them, except the ladies.
Please look at my bollocks.
But most of us don't even find our own particularly interesting.
Oh,
and
no.
To get up on a stage every night and just pull out your bollocks and expect applause, all I can say is, hey, Denver, zip it up. I only wish we could zip up his mouth, but sadly his physical resemblance to Zippy doesn't extend as far as the useful.
I mean, it's true. I mean, this whole business about soulfulness, people think it's an inherent virtue to be soulful, but, you know, most people have got mediocre souls, and Denver's obviously no exception.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's the pioneer of Ed Sheeranism. Mm. Really.
Ooh.
You know, like stripping down a potentially interesting and lively and affecting musical form to its barest and least emotionally complex and most dumbly commercial elements, and then presenting those in a context of reassuring mediocrity and making millions. And not doing that out of cynicism or financial ambition, but as a genuine, perfectly natural expression of your personal mediocrity. Mm. And if you do that slickly, you can never go wrong with it from a career point of view, because there's always going to be loads of people who will relate to that and feel very comfortable.
Absolutely. That's it. And say you wrote it in 10 minutes. I mean, it took you that long.
But yeah, the wedding song of 1974. If you had older cousins or aunties or whatever who were getting married in 1974, you had to sit there in your horrible tiny three-piece suit with a bow tie on a bit of elastic and be made to listen to this without even being able to touch the buffet, and it just wasn't fair.
Mm.
I bet the Wilkins in the family, when they got married, I bet this got played.
Still, I'm glad I saw this clip, by which I mean I'm glad I saw it, as opposed to I'm still seeing it.
Yes. So Annie's song would spend 1 week at number one, giving way to Sad Sweet Dreamer by Sweet Sensation. The follow-up, Back Home Again, failed to chart, and this remains his only sniff of the British charty arse as a solo artist, although his collaboration with Placido Domingo on Perhaps Love got to number 46 for 3 weeks in late 1981, early 1982. I can't believe that. Only one hit.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Sadly, Denver and Annie got divorced in 1982 when the relationship went from her filling up his censors to getting on his tits. It led to a massive row over alimony, which culminated in Denver taking a chainsaw into the house and cutting their marital bed in half. And he was killed in a plane crash in 1997. And of course, the song lives on in Britain thanks to the supporters of Sheffield United, who adopted the lyrics to read, "You fill up my senses like a gallon of Magnet, like a packet of Woodbines, like a good pinch of snuff, like a night out in Sheffield, like a greasy chip butter. Oh, Sheffield United, come thrill me again.
You fill up my senses. Come fill me again."
Oh, fantastic. That, of course, is the sound of John Denver. That long time, he finally made it to the top. And the story, all about Annie, who, of course, is his wife. Lovely sounds of Annie's song. 74, a great year for Alvin Stardust. He's here on Top of the Pops with his Jealous Mind.
Thank you.
who has clearly dropped the British accent he had in the 1972 Christmas show, goes into his awful northern accent as he comes out of Annie's song and then introduces a man who's had a great 1974, Alvin Stardust with My Jealous Mind.
Yeah, Noel here, the way he says, Alvin Stardust with his jealous mind. He's always trying to work the title into a sentence very awkwardly. And I hate that when anybody does it, most of all when it's Noel, just because of the creak of it. And he does it all the time. He's like, this is Donna Summer and she feels some love. This is Can and they want some more. It's a petty peeve, but to me it's excruciating. And half the time, it doesn't even fit with the actual lyrics of the song. It's like, here's Christa Berg, and he is the lady in red.
Edmunds, it's just one of those people that thinks that accents doing voices in itself denotes humour. You don't have to try any harder than that.
We last chanced upon the king of the Mansfield Delta in chart music number 3 when he took My Cuckoo to number 2 in December of 1973. This is the follow-up, but it's also the first Alvin Stardust single which the former Bernard Jewry has actually sung on, instead of having to mime to the vocals of Pete Shelley, who has settled for just writing and producing from here on in. It entered the charts at number 22 in the middle of March, then soared 19 places to number 3, and a fortnight later, it knocked Devilgate Drive off the top spot. And here's Alvin and his mates returning for an encore performance. Oh, Alvin, you're always welcome on Chart Music, Duck.
I mean, we'd have to ask, you know, is Shaking Stevens shaking Alvin? Really?
I don't think Stevens comes anywhere close to the majesty of Alvin Stardust.
I agree.
It's weird because Alvin Stardust has basically got to be the Alvin Stardust in My Cuckoo, which was actually somebody else in Tyler. Mm. He's trapped in this role, but oh, what a role, and he plays it so well.
Yeah. I mean, it's fair to say that he said 99.99% of what he had to say in My Cuckoo, but even so, you know, he's got that kind of, you know, Ian McShane vibe about him that's very pleasing. Of course,
very much so.
And of course, the glove lives on in the Rock Expert as well, you know, so, yes, you know, we cannot forget, definitely.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great forgotten number ones of the 70s, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, as we pointed out in that episode of Chart Music, everyone assumes that My Cuckoo was his biggest hit, but no, it's not. It's this.
Yeah, and this record must have come as a bit of a shock to his fans. Like, they'd heard My Cuckoo and they thought they had this guy pinned down.
Yes.
Yeah, well, forget that.
But this is how you bring rock and roll into the 70s, isn't it? You know, screaming guitar, meaty drums, and a front man who's clearly too old for this sort of thing, having a moody cavort.
Yeah.
It's fucking brilliant, man.
Yes.
As before, he's in his all black leather rig out with matching gloves and a big chunky ring, and his pompadour's been puffed out even more, and his sideburns are even beefier. The overall look is that he's being skull fucked by a baby chimpanzee, isn't it? Bummer chimp. Imagine coming home from school one day and you open the door and your Ted dad's in the living room cosplaying as Diana Rigg. This is the look, isn't it?
Yeah. It's great. It's like, his hair is worth talking about here, though.
Oh, he, I mean, talk away.
He got lockdown hair, basically.
Mm.
But it's like a lot of people in the 70s who wanted to recall the styles of the 50s but couldn't quite bear to cut their hair off at the back.
Yeah.
Which I think is really the origin of the mullet.
Yes.
Right? Like the Fonz in the later series of Happy Days, or Brian Ferry when he quiffed it up in the 80s. I think it's what Bowie was trying to do with the Ziggy Stardust haircut, which is kind of the OG mullet,
right?
Which is stand it on end for rock and roll, but without being so hopelessly square as to leave your collar visible. So you get this terrible halfway house. You'd see a lot of 70s guys not fully committing to the quiff because they'd been growing out their hair since 1964 and they just couldn't bear to chop it off.
Yeah.
And also I think they were possibly worried that someone would see them from the back and think that they had a short back and sides like hung up old Mr. Normal. So you end up with this half and half, which really combines the worst of both, you know.
Yeah.
Or it's for weekend rockers who want to have the long floppy hair in the week for urban camouflage and then just quiff it up on special occasions. No. This lack of commitment has a cost, and the cost is you're going to look shit.
It's kind of, yeah, it's sort of a hybrid. It's like the... Yeah, the Sethifties.
What are you going on about, David?
The Aventies. You've got the Aventies, would you?
The Fifenties, surely.
Well, you could have that as well. Yeah.
I love his giallo gloves, though. Like a kinky, sexualized 1970s Italian murderer.
Yes.
Whose identity is concealed for most of the film. You just get a POV shot of his strangling hands. Probably in the last scene, he'll turn out to be an old lady or a dwarf. Or the main young female protagonist, who somehow survived the murder spree. Hey, you didn't expect that. And it doesn't need to make sense.
No.
I've actually got a pair of black leather gloves a bit like this, and it's funny because if I wear them with a suit or a nice leather jacket, I look like an Italian murderer.
Right.
But if I wear them with a zipped-up parka and jeans, I look like an ageing rock star who owns a helicopter. I like both of them.
But the main difference between the performance of Mike Cuccio and this one is that his band have changed. You know, gone are the egg and chippers in the scoop-neck pink T-shirts, and in their place are younger lads in less durable and luxuriant black rig-outs.
Yeah.
Looks good.
Yeah. The thing, I think there's a sort of theme actually running throughout this episode of like the sort of the backing musicians, stroke session musician, whatever, kind of just having a bit of a laugh, really. They're just strumming away on these bog basic, piss easy chords, you know. They probably could do a note for note of Ritchie Blackmore on Sweet Child of Mine if they've been asked to. But, you know, this is the gig that they get, you know. And you think that, like, in a way, you know, people talk about post-punk and the intensity of post-punk. And I think that comes from the fact that the players, they're having to concentrate furiously on getting every change right, you know. But, you know, these guys, they can just swish away or grin or even play Patacate mid-song, you know. But there's kind of a vibe running through this.
It's a very end of term feel, isn't it?
Very end of term, and it's almost like a cultural end of term.
They should have played Crossfire Alvin was carrying on.
Yeah, it's got a cultural end of term feel as well, yeah.
Although Alvin does come really close to clonking the keyboard player in the teeth with that mic stand.
He
does a little comedy jab.
Just look how skilled Alvin is. What mic standsmanship? You know, there's none of this poncy Freddie Mercury half a stand bollocks. He just sees this chunky mic stand and he just hoiks it up and then points it at the camera and twirls it, and then he holds it in one gloved fist so he can point at his jealous mind. Then he uses it as a claw to ensnare his pianist, like he's trying to win him in a fairground. And once again, that pianist is hunched over awkwardly and not deploying the Alexander technique and is therefore paying for it right now. But fucking hell, worth the price, I think.
I think maybe the keyboard player's being punished for having his white underpants sticking out the top of his black ice skater bell bottoms at the back, which lets the side down a bit. Although, actually, I looked closely, it might not be. That might actually just be his skin. He is one of those unhealthy-looking 70s blokes. Even with that helmet of blonde hair that makes him look like he's trying to save his sweetheart from Matthew Hopkins.
But no, to my mind, this is a fucking tune.
Yes.
And what a welcome relief from the last two songs we've had. This episode has officially begun here with Alvin.
Yes, Christmas has officially begun.
This, of course, chaps, is taken from his debut LP, The Untouchable, which came out late last year, and it's inspired me to turn to a book which is currently residing in bedrooms right across the country, the 1975 Music Star Annual. As always, the cover delivers a snapshot of the stars of the day. So we get Donny Osmond, Noddy Holder, Elton John, Susie Quattro, David Cassidy and Gary Glitter. But inside is a penetrating interview with Alvin, which I'd like to share with you right now. Headline, How to Touch Mr. Untouchable. I am the untouchable. No one is allowed to get close to me. Not yet, Alvin told us, putting his feet up on the desk in his manager's office and showing off his leather boots. You see, I even wear gloves. That means that no one can touch me even if they want to. Not my skin or the real me. But why should he be so distant, especially from the people who love him? I am a star. I love my fans. I love everyone around me. I love making music. I love my family. Just because I don't let anyone come too close doesn't mean I don't love them. But for the moment, it is very important to me that I stay apart. I don't want to reveal anything about myself right away. I want to keep a few secrets for a rainy day. Anybody and everybody who really loves me must understand that. In time, you will be able to touch me. But I never want to be the same way as some of the stars. I think there are some who are truly distant from their fans. It's all outward show and nothing in the heart. With me, it's the other way round. I have a lot in my heart. For all my fans out there who are reading this, I want you to know that I love you and I would do anything for you. I'll be faithful to you. Will you be for me?
Very naturalistic, that, yeah, I can definitely.
Round about this time, he'd do interviews with the music press, particularly the serious music press, flanked by two massive henchmen who would wag fingers and tap on shoulders and look menacingly if the journo asked a question that Alvin didn't like.
I don't think that's the true Alvin.
No.
Also, we've got to remember that he's responsible for a generation of city kids not being flattened like roadkill, you know? It's
yes,
you can't, you know.
That's how you get to touch Alvin.
Absolutely.
Just by legging it across a road.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I could have done with Alvin Stardust back in 1969, you know, I got run over, you know, I was out of my tiny mind. I'd been sent out by my mum to buy Echo margarine with a sixpence and cross the busy road, didn't look right, didn't look left, and you know, I got walloped by this green Cortina, and my life saved by a sort of a grassy verge. So there you go.
See, swings and roundabouts, JFK and you, David.
The thing is, more than anything else, and this may not be totally obvious to modern-day viewers, it may require expert vision, which is what we're here for, and why we earn the big bucks. But this is pure North Country steam rising off the TV screen, right?
Yes.
This is an authentic expression of sex under Artex, or at least of a bit of digital manipulation in a steamed-up Morris Marina with a handbrake on near some chimneys. Or a colliery wheel. It's not romantic, but it's sex, right? And because people in those days had to work for their sex in ways that the youth don't really understand now, because nowadays it may be as hard as ever to find anyone prepared to have sex with you, certainly for blokes. But other than that basic obstacle, most of the other barriers have been cleared away, metaphorically and physically, right? Like, I mean, in spiritual terms, most people have now been cleansed of that spurious Christian hangover, faux morality, and that deeply misogynistic Taliban-esque concept of honour, you know. And to a great extent, they've left behind the terror of pregnancy. And also, physically, people are now less likely to be battling their way through layers of two-inch-thick clothing and huge armoured undergarments from sternum to knee, you know, with tights over them. And all the concomitant incubated yeast infections and forests of musty pubic hair, you know, the unwashed British slime, you know, just the fug rising off foul-smelling, undeodorised, unmaintained bodies, you know. And
Merry Christmas, everyone.
People so protected by their society from any kind of useful sex education or visual representation of sexual contact, they literally don't know what to do, right? And all these things still live on here and there, but nowadays they're not an electrified ring fence around non-marital sexual relationships or the accumulation of sexual experience for mutual pleasure and personal growth. So at least that stuff is less fraught these days. But it's starting to make British people almost blasé in the continental fashion. Whereas at this point in modern British history, if you were an ordinary person in an ordinary town and you wanted sex, you had to work for it. Not just locating and communicating with a prospective sexual partner. The actual practical physical act was like an assault course, not just for the body, but also for the straining libido, like tested to its limit. And it was only starvation and deranged hunger and the sexual tunnel vision that resulted from that, which allowed anyone to ever get through it, I think. If you put a modern person in a 1970s sexual situation, they'd be so turned off, they'd cut their losses and just go home for some toast, I think. And it's hard to explain to people, especially if they've grown up in a universe of Pornhub and Doja Cat and articles about fetish clubs in the lifestyle section of the Sunday Telegraph, you know. But despite how funny and good-natured and showbiz this top-of-the-box performance obviously is, at the time it would have looked almost too hot to touch. Because this was a country where as late as the mid-1950s, lest we forget, the Home Secretary was prosecuting seaside postcards for obscenity.
Yeah.
Like seafront sweet shop proprietors, bucket and spade shop proprietors were arrested as pornographers for selling them. And the unspeakable postcards themselves would be taken away and literally burnt in government furnaces. The ashes would then be shoveled out and dumped in the same pile as the ashes of all those impounded copies of Ulysses and the Decameron and Moll Flanders and Death War Bobby Socks by Hank Jansen, you know, all of which were regularly set alight by our spotless moral overlords in order to save our souls from corruption. And literally the only thing that stopped those mass book burnings was the Clean Air Act, which meant they had to start shredding them instead. And in what was basically still that country, this was practically hardcore pornography, you know. In 1974, a lot of men, or at least men who were not fortunate enough to be in the Rolling Stones, would have to gulp and run a finger around the inside of their shirt collar at the slightest glimpse of cellulite, you know, or the gust of wind up a miniskirt provided them with a quick flash of old cotton drawers sagging round the backside. Blokes would just spontaneously ejaculate, you know. And remember, this also is only a couple of decades after Alvin's fellow Nottinghamshire legend, D.H. Lawrence, having been forced to relocate to Italy, was having all his letters to his British publishers opened by the Home Office in their ongoing attempt to silence and suppress the honesty of his otherwise unremarkable writing, to the extent of at one point trying to put pressure on his baffled Parisian publishers not to publish his work in French, lest it creep back across the channel to deprave and corrupt the bilingual. This is where we were as a country, right? And this, 1974, this is a time when local councils, which were always cobwebbed covens of weirdos and crusty old misfits, as they still are, had de facto control over cinema censorship at the local level and would exercise that control so enthusiastically that, according to James Furman, the former head of the British Board of Film Classification, at this time, West Yorkshire was the most heavily censored region in the English-speaking world, including apartheid South Africa.
Fuck.
And meanwhile, Mary Whitehouse and cohorts were insisting that despite all this, we were all submerged in filth and these laws needed to be further tightened up very severely at the cost, or as they would see it, the benefit of turning a historically lewd and vicious country into a silent fascist theocracy, as if that were Britain's natural state and everything else was a perversion. And in this very year, 1974, the police had seized More About the Language of Love, which was an only mildly exploitative Swedish sex education film, which had been passed with an X certificate by the GLC, but which the police independently decided to seize and prosecute as an obscene article after two plainclothes policemen went to see it in a West End cinema, despite being told as they went in by the shuddering old woman in the ticket office, "I don't know why you want to see that film. It's just sex, sex, sex." She even puts it in her mouth. But This determination to keep Britain in a state of arrested development, sexually and psychologically, and to close off all those avenues of self-expression and that connection with our own essential humanity, and to deny British people by law the opportunity to understand that sex is the only kind of everyday pleasure which doesn't ultimately feel empty and temporary and worthless in the face of crushing capitalist routine, and does make almost any life seem worth living, and crucially does show up the hypocritical morals of the old British establishment as twisted and dangerous and ultimately evil. That determination to deny us all of that was so great, and for various reasons considered so important and such a high priority, that cases like that were rushed before the courts, while actual sex crimes and large-scale sexual abuse were frequently not prosecuted at all.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases, offenders were protected from prosecution to preserve the spotless image of the British establishment so that it could continue to moralise and forbid. And in this context, Alvin Stardust's attempts to do authentic raunch English style with only the flimsiest sheath of humour and silly bugger pantomime are really something. And obviously, no cultural commentator at the time looked at this and thought, fucking hell, what we've got here is a poptastic reincarnation of D.H. Lawrence. And we would laugh if they had. That's stupid. But it's not quite the stupidest thing you could say about Alvin Stardust. It really isn't. And on these grounds, I also have new respect for Lisa Goddard.
You know what you could have done with, I suppose, at this stage, is for Alvin Stardust to have sort of fronted a campaign for the sexual highway code. Going into bedrooms, hey, you know, doing it wrong. Hey, you out of your tiny mind?
Just walking in. You got like, you see all those 70s bedrooms all done out in Brentford nylons. And flock wallpaper, and all those big coffin wardrobes. The door just flies open. Hey, you.
Yes, point. But yeah, Sixpence is Elvis. Fuck it, he really set the template, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Because isn't this the year, Taylor, that Eli Culberson came over from America and pretended to be Elvis in Heathrow Airport and went on liftoff with A'Shea and performed the most obscene Elvis impersonation ever with some fucking girl guide sitting at his feet.
Yes. Oh, fucking
hell. Man, you must see that clip, Pop Craze Youngsters. It's incredible.
Oh, yeah. Put video playlist.
So Jealous Mind would spend 1 week at the top, deposed by Billy Don't Be a Hero by Paperlace. Fucking hell, Nottinghamshire, the cradle of pop. The follow-up, Red Dress, would get to number 7 in May. You made it to number 6 in September, and he'd finish off his most prolific year with Tell Me Why, becoming this week's number 16. Sadly, diminishing returns set in rapidly in 1975, and the Wheel Tappers and Shunters circuit beckoned, but he'd roar back in the early 80s with 3 top 10 hits, and he died in 2014 at the age of 72. I wish I could have interviewed Alvin Stardust. Have you seen that massive long interview with someone from Cherry Red Records on YouTube? It's fucking brilliant.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's just captivating.
Oh, he's such a nice bloke.
Well, just my blaming all my jealous mind. Well, just my
Alvin Stardust for you there, and Jealous Mind. Well, at this point in the proceedings, oh, forgive this, by the way, we decided as it's sort of Christmas that we'd have it in stereo. The other speaker's in the kitchen. Where are you? This is George McRae, Rock Your Baby.
Travis, on his own, holds up 2 microphones, and you already get the feeling that a bit is being deployed, which he wastes time on when he should be introducing the next act, which he finally does when he puts on that American disco voice he started to do round about this time and throws us into Rock Your Baby by George McRae. Born in West Palm Beach, Florida in 1944, George McRae formed the group The Jivin' Jets in his late teens before joining the Navy in 1963. 4 years later, when he came out, he formed a duo with his wife Gwen, and when she landed a solo record deal, he acted as her manager while keeping his hand in on session singing and club dates. Earlier this year, McRae was on the verge of chucking in the music business when he was approached by Harry Casey of Casey and the Sunshine Band, who had written a song that was out of his range and was offering it to Gwen. On the day of the recording, however, Gwen was running late, so Casey asked George to have a go. And by the time Gwen had arrived, the single was already in the can, and her husband suddenly had a solo career. With the single rocketing up the Billboard chart, it entered our chart in the last week of June, then soared 30 places to number 15, then bounded up to number 4 the week after that, then grabbed hold of She by Charles Aznavour and told it to fuck off out of the number 1 position. And here is the man himself. And chaps, after crossing the Atlantic and freezing his bollocks off in this frigid husk of an island so close to Christmas, how do the BBC treat him?
Like shit.
Not only is he having to perform on a set that's been encrusted with big emerald pyramids, which makes him look like he's been shrunk down and been imprisoned in a Quality Street tin by someone who likes everything bar the green triangles, but the opening sequence is George saying "sexy mama" or some such, then a Christmas cracker which pans up to a turkey carcass with some holly on the top and a carving knife rammed into it, which has been placed off to the side of him, and he's expected to sing in front of it. Why? I ask.
Yeah. Yeah, that turkey with a carving knife in it, like it's had a visit from Alvin Stardust. You know, POV shot dubbed with heavy breathing and Italian prog rock. There's a load of people listening to this laughing, and all the others going, "What is Italian prog rock? What's he on about?" I don't know. Yeah, we'll go and listen to Goblin. It's like English prog rock with better food. But yeah, they haven't really been asked to turn the studio into a winter wonderland, have they? It's fair to say.
I'm assuming this is a callback to the previous episode, and this is what's been left over after Mudd and David Essex have had a go at it.
Yeah. Or somebody's just not bothered to clear the stage properly, you know.
Yeah. I find it massively disrespectful.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
I mean, George would be looking at this going, "Oh, are you calling me a turkey?" I feel sorry for George McRae immediately, just because the fucking turkey's there. But also, I've got a feel for the poor bastard, because he must have been walking on eggshells all year with his missus. And this performance surely puts the tin lid on it. You can imagine him at home saying, "Oh, by the way, Gwen, I'm not going to be around to help you eat Christmas shopping, because I've got to go to London to do that song that you should have had, but you were late, remember?" You know, that song that got to number one in America, Britain, Canada, Austria, Belgium, Holland, Germany, Italy, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland. See you on Christmas Eve, Doc.
It's great. I like it now. I liked it at the time. It's just the effortless superiority. I mean, if something like this, it's like Pele coming up against Terry Darricot or something.
Although, in this particular version of Rock Your Baby...
Well, yes. Yes, there is that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's famous for being one of the first songs to employ a drum machine, but not in this version.
But this is the Top of the Pops Orchestra in mid-de-evolution. Like, we've seen that they went on what would now be called a journey.
Yes.
From backing Stevie Wonder and the Jackson 5.
And keeping up with them.
Yeah, not disgracing themselves to... just a few years later, essentially just randomly honking and squawking while Denise Williams was trying to sing a song.
Yes.
And I suppose this is sort of halfway through that transformation, you know, sort of hovering a little above Butlin's standard.
Yes.
You know? I mean, it's not as bad as their attempts to play Jamaican music.
No.
As seen on any Top of the Pops performance by a solo reggae singer, where the backing is not so much Sly and Robbie as Ray and Nobby. because they don't understand how in reggae music feeling is conveyed through the details of timing and inflection, and if you muff that, you're really going to sound like a BBC studio band reading charts under a big clock in a room painted hospital green, turning reggae into a variety show umpar. Like, you know that sound, right?
Yes.
When two Ronnies clash. Wait. Better one. L.E. Scratch Perry. And although soul music was never exactly their friend either,
no.
I think they'd have had much worse problems if soul music was still Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett stuff like that. Because, like, the Stax sound works the same way as reggae in terms of the playing. They really would have slaughtered those records beyond all recognition.
Oh, God.
But at least by this point, American soul music has a sort of slickness and a smooth line to it. So if you play in time and you get the notes right, even if you do sound cabaret sloppy, at worst you're going to come across as hacks rather than vandals. Although it's a close call on this one, because obviously the original backing track is so exquisite, and that's the main point of the record. And obviously this sounds horrible compared to that, but it's just, you know, unlike them doing Uptown Top Ranking or Sideshow by Barry Biggs, they don't turn a great record into a terrible record. They can only downgrade it to a much less good record. You know, because even without that magical rolling feel that you get on the real Rock Your Baby, just the notes and the arrangement and the singing are enough on their own to still sound good, just not in the same way. It doesn't sound sexy, which is a bit of a shame considering it's a record about sex. This is the same record but as an elderly virgin with those rim shots going all the way through it, going click click click, like a cane on the pavement outside Mr. Harper's the fishmonger at 8:30 a.m. on a Wednesday, picking up a bit of salmon for the cat.
I mean, obviously this is embryonic disco, I guess, 74.
Yes.
And there's beginning, and it's perhaps one of the first instances of a clash between, like, the machinery. Disco increasingly involves machinery, and in this instance, like, the drum machine, and the tension between that and, like, the musicians' union and, you know, TV studio orchestras. The culmination for me of that is there's footage somewhere of, like, Donna Summer doing I Feel Love. And, of course, they haven't got the kind of Moroder backing. They've just got this kind of TV studio audience sawing furiously away on their violins to kind of simulate that kind of sequencer effect. And, it's not great.
He wasn't the first one to use a drum machine. You know, Sly Stone used a drum machine throughout There's a Riot Going On, and Shuggy Otis used it, and, of course, Timmy Thomas. But this is the first one that really hit big.
Now, what's good about this, though, is that fabulous quick cutting between cameras that they do later on in the song.
Like they did with David Ansel Collins.
Double barrel.
Yeah,
it sort of lobs back a bit of the thrill that's been siphoned out of this track, you know. And in fairness to George, he does that too, because he really goes for it as wildly as he can, to his credit. He's not discouraged. He's trying to make up for the lost funk, you know.
And he's got the standard black male singer suit on, hasn't he? Just one of them zip-up all-in-one jobs with loads of spangles and whatnot on it.
You can look at this performance one of two ways, right? Either it's the amazing, very arguably one of the top 10 singles of the 70s, Rock Your Baby by George McRae, being desecrated by hacks, with George McRae right there to witness it, like a 17th century traitor having his entrails pulled out and held up in front of his face before he dies. Or it's British light entertainment cracking down the sides as it attempts to accommodate the sumptuous girth of Rock Your Baby by George McRae. And what you're watching is the dead past being torn asunder, because this, and not the record coming up next, this is now what ordinary people like.
Yes.
So really what we're seeing here is just one of the stranger artifacts of change at a point just before these old ways were banished to the echoing concrete corridors of the Little and Large Show for 10 years, and then finally into the grave with that audience. You can look at it either way, and neither of those two things is lovely listening, but it's better to think of it the second way, because that's much nicer to witness.
We've talked often about this song in previous chart musics, and, you know, even in the last episode, we talked about how this song influenced Dancing Queen and, by extension, Don't Make Waves by the Nolans. But, you know, but we can't hate it for that.
No.
But we can also kick in another song, which was Whatever Gets You Through the Night by John Lennon, which got to number one this year. And Lennon was quite open about nicking from it.
Yeah.
So this episode has properly picked right up now, hasn't it?
And nothing can go wrong from here.
No.
It's going from strength to strength to...
So Rock Your Baby would spend 3 weeks as the toppermost of the poppermost, eventually yielding the floor to When Will I See You Again by the 3 Degrees. The follow-up, I Can't Leave You Alone, got to number 9 for 2 weeks in October of this year, and his latest single, You Can Have It All, is currently at number 42 and will get to number 23 in January of 1975. He'd score one more big hit with It's Been So Long, which got to number 4 in August of 1975, then Diminish and Return set in, but he's still active today. Meanwhile, Gwen McCrae scored moderate hits of her own in the late 70s with Funky Sensation and All This Love That I'm Giving, which in their own way are just as fucking monumental. I love those songs. All This Love That I'm Giving is a fucking banger.
It is. Keep the Fire Burning. That's great. Mm.
And on that note, Pop Craze youngsters, we're going to step back, catch us breaths, and come back hard tomorrow for part 3 of Chart Music number 69. Always remember, if you're sick of being edged by us and you want it long and hard in one big go without any rubbish adverts, patreon.com/chartmusic, money down the G-string. All right, and Pop Craze youngsters, on behalf of Taylor Parks and David Stubbs, this is Al Needham, and you are staying pop crazed.
Chart Music.